everyone, dear viewers and listeners, to the remarkable special episode 10 of my podcast, Valhalla Conversations, where I, a self-confessed Viking geek, wanting to know all things Norse in all forms, both historical and modern, basically try and interview lots of my favourite authors, creatives, academics, and everything else in between. For this episode, episode 10, I am delighted to say that I am joined by Tilde Kold-Holt, the author of this wonderful book, Northern Wrath, if it's not obscured by my virtual new background, because I've relocated to Valhalla, as you can see, everyone. Northern Wrath, which is the first in her trilogy, The Hanged God series, and I have read it and I have enjoyed it a lot. I have lots of questions. And if you haven't read it, get it on your Christmas list pronto. Buy it, download it, borrow from any good library. They should have it in. So to slightly embarrass Tilde, I'm going to read her author profile from the back of the book, because then I know I'm getting my facts right. So I will just read it. Okay, so it says, Tilde Kold-Holt is a Viking, traveller and a polyglot fluent in Danish, French, English and Korean. As a writer, she is an avid researcher, and this is how she first came to row for hours upon hours on a Viking warship. We will ask more about that later, dear viewers and listeners. She loved the experience so much that she has sailed with the Viking ship, the Sea Stallion, ever since. Awesome name. Love that name for a ship. Another research trip brought her to all corners of South Korea, where she also learned the art of traditional Korean archery. And born in Denmark, Tilde has lived in many places and countries, taking a bit of each culture with her. This is why she regards herself as simply being from planet Earth. But she has yet to set foot on Mars. Noble goals there, Tilde. I hope you get there one day. Excuse me. And she is currently based in southern France, where she writes full time. And I know from previous conversations, she has a vineyard of sorts. So you have quite a life already under your belt.
Yeah. It's been some busy years.
So I guess we'll start off with the first question that I ask nearly everyone I have on this podcast is, what drew you to Viking history / mythology in the first place? What brought you into the fold of my geekiness?
It's a good question. For me, I think it was the fact that I was born in Denmark, but I grew up outside of Denmark. So when I was 10, I came to live in southern France with my family. And when you arrive as a Scandinavian in a foreign country, you automatically gain the title, the Viking. So I obviously became the Viking, not really knowing exactly what that actually encompassed. Mm-hmm. And so as I got a bit older, I started to get interested to know more. I started doing research, and that's kind of what led me to Vikings and all things Norse, because I feel like I really found the thing that I connect with in Denmark is the Viking culture and that ancient worldview. So there was something I could hold on to there. And there are so many interesting stories and interesting things and facets about Vikings that I had to write about it. So that's pretty much how it all came about.
That's wonderful. Well, if it's any consolation, my nickname in my group of mum friends, because I am a parent, is the Viking, because they all know that's my thing, and none of them know anything. One of my mum friends was like, "Who's Thor? How do they know about Thor? Is he in the books?" I'm like, no. I don't know how to answer that question. Let me get back to you. Because that's
a lecture, and then I will answer it.
Yes, because some of them don't even watch the Marvel movies, so that's how distant they are. So this is why I do this podcast, Tilde, because I need to talk about Vikings with people that know about Vikings.
Love that.
And alas, no one in my family or immediate friends, and definitely not my mum network, has that kind of fascination, or at least not the level of obsession that I nearly have. Yeah. I'm just borderline obsessed, really.
I get the feeling. Listen, I've been there. And it's just nice to connect with people who have the same kind of interest and who can bring something new, because you just talk about things in a different way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I am honoured to have you on board, and thank you for agreeing to do this episode with me. So I guess I'm curious, which came first? Was it your experience on the Viking longship, or was it writing Northern Wrath?
So it happened simultaneously. So I was actually writing Northern Wrath, and I was halfway through what today is book one. So back when I was writing it, book one was actually two books. Ooh. And then later on, I combined them into one. So I'd just written the first half, and I was still doing research, all the time doing research. And so I was taking lots of trips to Denmark, where my parents still partly lived, and I still had family up there. And so on one of these research trips, I went to the Viking Warship Museum in Roskilde. And they have reconstructions of different Viking ships. And one of them is a huge warship, which biggest reconstructed warship to exist. And I saw that they were actively sailing it. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool just to go out once? I'll see if it's even possible. And so I looked it up, and they said they were looking for sailors. So I applied, and I got in, and I became a long-term crew member. Yeah. So. So it kind of came about in a roundabout way while doing research, and then the opportunity was there.
So how many rowers does that warship need?
So that's a very good question, because that's actually how we measure the size of a warship or a ship, is the amount of oars that it has. So this is a 60-oar ship, so 30 oars on either side. But when we row, we usually row on every other oar, because it's easier. So that would be 30 rowers at once, usually, when we row.
Gosh. And were there many other women like yourself on board the crew?
Yeah, definitely. Best rowers are usually women. So, I mean, you have to have the good technique. If you don't have the big muscles, then you have to have the good technique, and that just means that you go further. So, a lot of very, very cool women on board, a lot of different kinds of people, young people, older people, all kinds of professions, all kinds of backgrounds and reasons for being there. So it was really very Viking, very diverse group of people, as it would have been in the Viking age when you get aboard a ship like that.
Wow. Oh, I am actually jealous, but then I know that I would be rubbish, because this is why some people often ask, like, why don't you do Viking reenactments, Rebecca? And I'm like, have you seen these pipe cleaner arms? I didn't want to be by the fire just null binding and cooking all the time, but then it's just the amount of time and effort that some of these guys, and I've spoken to a few in my life, and the dedication they have, and also geographically, sometimes the nearest meeting point for such groups isn't near me.
That's my issue as well, because I have to go all the way to Denmark to be part of it, right? So currently I don't sail with the ships because it's just too far away, and I don't go to Denmark enough, so I can't justify it. But at the time, I definitely made a lot of time for many years to go as often as I could to really be there. If I lived there nearby, obviously it would be every weekend, but it's just not feasible.
We both just need to win a national lottery and just buy a house together and just live our dreams. That's what we need to do.
Exactly. That's what everyone ought to do.
Oh, fabulous. So, Northern Wrath. It is what I would call Norse fantasy, which, to explain to anyone who hasn't heard the coinage of the word before, I'm not even sure it's an official term, but I use it a lot, is basically fantasy with Norse elements, whether it's Viking Age or whether it's Norse fantasy. And yours marvellously blends a bit of both, because it has got lots of mythology and cedar magic and runes, and I'm trying not to spoil too much. But it's also set in an era of Viking Age history, which I don't think is actually featured, or I've not come across it much in terms of other popular culture modern mediums, which is, of course, the rise of Harald Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So would you mind giving our viewers and listeners a brief recap of who Harald Bluetooth is and why we should know about him?
Obviously. So Harald Bluetooth is a very well-known figure in Denmark, even today. He is today considered the first king of Denmark, the first real king. And he is the person who is credited as Christianing the Danes, so as changing their religion, which today is viewed as a very positive thing. But in my book, Northern Wrath, I can't say I'm exactly on his side. So I take a bit of a different approach. So I think for a lot of Danes, the portrayal of him is quite shocking and different, because he is a very well-known figure that we learn about in history classes today in Denmark as well. So he is considered a hero for saving Denmark, for uniting the land, for Christianing it, and being its first real original king. And I take a bit of a different view in Northern Wrath, in that, well, if you Christianed all of the Danes, then you're basically taking their freedom of religion away from them. Is that always positive? I don't think so. And the way that he went about certain things, when you actually look at the facts, I think are a bit questionable. So my portrayal of him is a bit different from what we usually see in history classes in Denmark. And that's a big reason why I wrote about him. So I remember being a kid until I was 10, I was educated in Denmark. And I remember learning about Harald Bluetooth when I was 8 or something like that, and having a visceral reaction to hearing about Bluetooth, feeling like, why is he portrayed as a hero? He took their freedoms away. He made it easier to invade the lands. Like, what happened? Their culture disappeared very soon after that. So when I started researching Vikings, that memory sparked up again, and I started looking further into it. And yeah, that's kind of why I decided to set it in this era. I think it's always interesting when you see a shift, be a big religious or cultural shift, and that is definitely what happened during Harald Bluetooth's time. We are seeing Vikings who were very Norse and had their set of traditions and culture and believed in their gods go from this to becoming Christian in a very short period. Obviously, it was something that happened over a long time, but the shift is very noticeable during Harald Bluetooth's time. So I was quite interested by that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it. Especially because I know, coming from the UK side, of course, we had lots of Danish and Norwegian and probably some Sweden. Of course, these nations didn't exist back when they started coming over and settling among us, but it was kind of a process of assimilation where they willingly took on the Christian type aspects because it helped their trade, or their wife was Christian, or their daughter married a Christian, that kind of thing. Whereas Harald Bluetooth was kind of telling them all off, like, no, you shall stop worshiping Odin, you shall now worship the one god, and then I'll be king of you all, kind of thing. So yes, because it's a guy I've not read about much in non-fiction. Certainly I don't think I've come across him much in any other of my historical fiction books. Nope. I'm thinking my bookshelves, and pretty much they're all either before or after his time. So it's quite refreshing to come across another new figure in historical fiction. And of course, you've brought their world view to life wonderfully with the elements of Norse mythology and fantasy coming through. And I would like to say that you set off the ground running with that beautiful, like, short introduction prologue of a chapter with, of course, there's many main characters in this book, dear viewers and listeners. It's a wonderful tapestry of characters, and their storylines blend and weave in absolute perfection. There's no getting confusion at all. It's really well written. Is Einar, who turns out to have a bit of a berserker streak inside him. And I like how you explore that coming through not just kind of like a mushroom-powered frenzy, but something of a divine spark inside him, which is later explored a bit and answered a bit more definitely by the end of Northern Wrath.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I think that touches on like a key thing about this book for me, is that it started as historical fiction, and then I started to realize I couldn't write about the Vikings without writing about the gods, because it was such a big part of who they were and how they viewed the world. So if they didn't fully believe in it, it wasn't going to work. And in fully believing in the gods and writing them as such, the gods started to appear in the text and the magic started to appear in the text. And then I knew I was off in a historical fantasy world now. So I might as well just commit and bring the gods in and have a little chat with them. So that's a lot of those elements, like the berserker elements, do have a cultural part as well. That comes, I think, partly from the religion. So that's something I definitely wanted to drive in as well, to have that magical component be part of it.
Yeah, you've done something really nice with the mythology that I like and love and adore in Northern Wrath, especially when you're dealing with the subject, without spoiling it too much, of mortals that either maybe not mortal as they appear or have some kind of heritage linked to the other beings of the Nine Worlds, and that not quite a demigod but not quite demi-mortal kind of aspect. And because there's another fascinating character in there, which is called Hilda. Yeah, Hilda. And she is what many like to believe is more common now, is, of course, a young woman of Danish heritage wanting to take up the sword, the axe, the shield, and get involved with all the men. Because, of course, it's still an issue of this academic debate. But I'm an academic, so I can say what I like. To a degree. No one can quote me on it. Well, they can quote me, but I'll say that's what I believe. And I like how you've presented that quite well, especially with her father, who is another figure which has a very, very interesting storyline, which is her father Ragnar, who is a bit of a scold, a storyteller. And his initial introduction as being like, no, Hilda, you will stay at home, you will not go on the raids, I will not have you doing this. And it's that whole issue of a woman trying to find her place in the world with what she wants compared to what society and, of course, the hierarchy and the, of the masculine telling her what to do. So I like how you kind of started quite hot off the topic, not just with Einar's storyline, but with hers as well.
Yeah, thank you. I think for Hilda as well and for Ragnar, for their dynamic, I think her father is scared of seeing her die. And that is actually his main reason for opposing her going off. He's afraid of being alone all of a sudden because her mother is no longer around. She had a brother who's no longer around. He's scared of now being possibly all alone. So he's very visceral in his reaction. And he, you can say, kind of blocks her in every way that he can because he's quite influential. So he makes people promises that they won't take her. And she obviously thinks it's her right, which... if you believe in a society where women fighters were around, it's as much her right as it's a man's right. So for her, it's a completely fraught view of the world that kind of goes a bit with the new wave of Christianity that's driving through that definitely does not want her to go on raids because you're a woman and you shouldn't be on raids. So it is a bit of that early conflict coming in. So both the religious conflict and also the familiar context of, well, Ragnar is just terrified and he will use any means and any reason to keep her away from it. And Hilda thinks this is completely unfair. So it is bringing in the family dynamic, but also introducing the cultural elements of this clash of periods where something that used to be normal, even just the fact of being a raider, being a warrior, used to be much more common. And during the period of Northern Wrath, it's already starting to be a profession that's not that relevant anymore, that doesn't really pay, it's difficult, why would you even do this? And so finding herself trying to become it, become a warrior and keep this tradition alive, but against the clash of a changing culture and a changing time.
Well, I really liked her, and she has, I think, the most remarkable storyline I've ever come across in Northern Wrath. And at points, you explore different aspects of the mythology and worldview of the Vikings, again, in ways that I've not come across in other books, especially in terms of how they viewed aspects of themselves. Like the way I'm going to describe it for viewers and listeners is think of Philip Pullman's Northern Light series, where in Lyra, one of the two names, I always get it confused. She has like a spirit animal that mimics herself. And in this book, you have a character that develops that ability to see and in some ways dominate, interestingly enough, their spirit animal. So would you like to tell us more about
that? I love that. So this came out of all of my research about mythology. So the Vikings did believe in the concept that we today would probably call spirit animals. For them, it was called fylgjur or fylgja. And it's said that your fylgja is like your luck. So it comes to warn you in dangerous situations. So to see it is not always a positive thing. It can be a warning that danger is coming, watch out. They also had a different kind of spirit animal that they would see in their dreams. It's not necessarily the same one. But fylgjur are kind of related to the bloodline as well because they're often inherited. So they're often an ancestor's fylgjur that you then get. So this also comes up in Northern Wrath. So when I was doing research, I didn't find a lot on it, but I found enough where I was like, I have to include this because so many of the gods are also talked about as having animals with them. Freya is talked about as always having cats around. Obviously, we have Odin with his ravens and his two wolves. So I was like, there's something here that I think I could explore and it would be really fun and interesting to do. So yeah, it came up organically as I was writing Hilda. I was writing a scene that no longer exists in the book. But she was basically being chased. And the reason that she knew that she was in danger was because she saw her fylgja for the first time. And so it kind of sparked from that. And her fylgja kept popping up. And then when I went through, I added more scenes with it. And it became an integral part of the story.
Yeah. It's remarkable, especially the twist at the end. It put my heart in my mouth. But yes. That's all I'm going to say, because I do not want to spoil it.
That one, actually. So without giving away what the twist is, I think the reason that one is in there is actually because of Odin. So when you read about Odin and his wolves, it says that the wolves eat for Odin, that he never eats for himself.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that kind of sparked the idea in my mind. I was like, maybe there's something here. And yeah.
Well, you do, like, in all... In the many non-fiction books I've read, and I've still got lots more, she says, looking at a very full bookcase, It always, any depictions of Valhalla, you certainly always hear the Valkyries providing like meat and mead for the warriors, but you never really hear about the gods being served and what the gods eat, apart from Idun's apples, of course, because that keeps them eternally young.
You do have the tale where Locusina, where they're eating at Aegir's hall and they're...
Oh gosh, yes.
They do eat together, but we don't necessarily hear them eat around mortals or around, you know, their dead warriors or something else like that, yeah.
You made me think now, of course they do eat, because of course we have the whole saga of Fafnir and Regin and the killing the otter to then eat it, and then when they encounter Skathi's Skathi's dad, I forgot his name, but he kept making the fire too cold so their meat wouldn't cook. Gosh, yes, that is a really interesting thing. That should be a topic of research. Someone should research food and gods.
Which is why I think it's even more interesting that it's two places that I saw it was written that Odin, that his wolves eat for him. I thought, that's an interesting point. And I will definitely have that. Yeah.
Wow. Well, speaking of other beings, we've talked about the gods and Fluga and the spirit animals. You do a wonderful, almost deep dive into a remarkable culture and society that you've made, not just for the dwarves, but for the giants in Northern Wrath. And I really like how you've depicted them, not as the big brutes, but actually kind of like a very clever and intelligent structured society. And the dwarves themselves I find fascinating, especially there's one scene where there's one giant and one dwarf who meets one of the other characters. There's a lot of characters in this book, I'm not going to name names, it was, but they meet them in a certain underground environment. There's almost a bit of a Smeagol and Bilbo exchange of oaths and riddles to make it up. And I love that. I thought that feels so Norse in itself, just kind of like making one's oath literally and binding it just by saying it out loud, as well as kind of the aspect of names and identity and heritage. Yeah. I thought that was really well done.
Thank you. I think a lot of those kinds of scenes also come from just the memories I have from my childhood and the Norse stories that we used to hear and that I really connected with. Like the passage graves come up quite a lot, and there's so many of them across Denmark, and there used to be even more. A lot of them have been plowed away by farmers over the years, but there used to be so many of them, and there's still a lot when you go around out in the countryside and just see nature. You'll see these sudden grave mounds everywhere, and a lot of them do have passages. So that's something that definitely came up a lot. So the environment, and then just the tone of it. Because a lot of the stories that I got told as a child were troll stories and things like that that do have origins in Norse stories. So when you go back and you look at the old Poetic Edda or things like that, you see I know a modern version of this that I was told years later, but it actually originated with the Vikings, with the Norse mythology and all of that. And the dwarves and the way they're treated in Norse mythology definitely comes from that. Have a lot of stories of those when I was a kid. Trolls, which are commonly referred as the Jotun, one aspect of Jotun. A lot of stories about trolls today in Denmark as well. So that also came back, a lot of them from the old stories of Norse mythology.
Well, having recently had a bit of a dream experience in Norway at the Mari Symposium, when I was in the airport in Stavanger waiting to fly home, I bought my child a book called The Little Troll. And we read it over a number of nights because it's possibly too long to read to her in one sitting, but she enjoyed it. I kind of always made a bit of a cliffhanger when we ended it. But there's a point where it comes across a troll with three heads and one eye, and they swap them between them. I thought, this feels so much like the Norns blended with the fate from Greek mythology. It was so interesting. And there was a weird scene where there was a troll waiting to catch a train in the hope of saving a princess who would fall off the train. Okay, fair enough. That's cool.
Trolls are a big component. Trolls are big. Definitely more Norway, but all across Scandinavia and the Nordics, I think trolls are very big. And a lot of them do come back to stories about Jotun. And I think, I mean, you mentioned Smeagol. Tolkien has a lot in a lot of his stories. He has things that originate from back then. For example, the trolls in his stories in The Hobbit that turn to stone when the sunrise comes up. That's a traditional Norse story about Thor speaking to a dwarf, and the dwarf turns to stone when the sun comes up. So I reference that story. But yeah, that's an ability that's usually associated with dwarves in Norse mythology.
Well, speaking of dwarves, there is a point where a particular character, and I'm not going to say his name, has to free a dwarf from stonification, petrification effectively. And he meets a very interesting character, which I can only describe as being more akin to a vulva. Would you agree with that?
Yes,
So,
definitely.
what's your take on vulvas, and how did you decide to weave them into your story?
Yeah, so good question. So I decided, because in not in when you read the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, they always refer to the vulva as if there's only one. But obviously, when we talk about vulva today, we also talk about practitioners of said magic, so people who would maybe refer to as what would you say, magicians or something like that today in modern terms.
Which is the modern term I've come across, basically described as a Norse witch, but I could be wrong.
Norse witch probably. Yeah, it's probably what you would call it in modern terms. The word witch didn't feel quite right to me personally, but I definitely wanted to make the distinction between the one that the gods have relations to and the ones that everyday people would go to for advice or for special runes to help them heal or something like that. So I made that distinction by calling them a different name. So I called the human ones rune mistresses or rune, and then the other ones vulva. But basically, they're both practitioners of runic magic. And the vulva, yeah, exactly, would be probably the biggest one since she services the gods primarily, and also mentioned one of the characters when he is in need of a special healing, I think you could say, in order to help himself. So that is a component that I think is the main practitioners of magic is important to understand where that comes from and that it's part of everyday life for a Viking, but also for the gods, because ultimately Vikings do reflect what they see in the gods. So what the gods do, they will do a version of. So yeah, still wanted to keep the distinction. So yeah, you're right that
That's very good. I completely forgot about the room mistress because she's also a really fascinating character.
She's a strong character. You don't see her that much, but yeah, but she's
But
there.
they're all fascinating. I don't think there's a character we don't meet that isn't fascinating. I mean, even to talk about one of, I guess, kind of like the lesser, basically kind of like the cast behind the prime cast, I was going to say is the character of Finn, because of course you think, oh, he's going to become the heartthrob of the story, but actually he doesn't. And the way you take his journey, especially near the end, because of course there is a big siege slash battle near the end of the book. And would you mind describing the location and what its meaning is historically for viewers
Of course.
listening?
So actually, Northern Wrath is based on true history in that in the year approximately 967. So I say approximately because there's some debate about who put that date down and who didn't, and whether we can believe him or not. But there are several accounts of it. There had been a lot of conflicts between the south, so you can say northern Germany, and the Scandinavian countries, because the Vikings would raid the coasts. Normal. And obviously, the southern kings did not appreciate this. And so, eventually, during one summer, as most of the Viking warriors were away, they sent the southern kings sent southerners up, warriors, to sack the villages in Scandinavia. And they got all the way up to the top of Jutland and then got basically beaten down by Harald Bluetooth, as it said, all the way down to the frontier. And it said that when Harald crossed the frontier, he was now in foreign territory and he suddenly saw the light of Christ and became Christian.
Typical.
As if by magic, and he returned home and Christianized everything. And yeah, everyone was happy. That's basically how the story goes in very basic terms. But so I base the whole story on this principle that the warriors are away. And so that's the opening, is that the warriors are away and the city gets sacked, the village gets raided, and everything kind of starts from that point on.
Definitely.
And then I take them, so for a revenge raid, you can say, down to the south, so in Germany, where there are many cities along rivers where we know that Vikings have been. Whether they were there that year or not, no one can say, but no one can deny either. So let's play with the history. So yeah, that's basically the story. So it all stems from a real historical event, and then I guess you can say my wishful thinking, because no one can prove what did and what didn't happen. But I hope that there would be some kind of response. And so that's kind of what I would think, how I would think a Viking or a Norse person in that situation would react.
Yes.
We need to honor the dead. And how do we do that? And so, that's kind of where the whole story stems from.
Well, it totally fits. I mean, I'm thinking back to when Sweyn Fortbeard heard about his cousin or niece being killed when Athelred decided to exterminate all Danes. And then, he came over, and that's how he came up with King Canute.
Yeah.
Basically. So what's the name of the city on the coast that they try and get into?
Yeah, it's Magdeburg. So it's Magdeburg. Yeah.
I didn't want to garble.
To be fair, I use the Norse way of saying it, so I write it the way that they used to write it out. Yeah.
Very good. Well, there is that entire battle. It feels very much like I'm watching a movie scene. It's described and captured brilliantly, both kind of like the close-up shots when you're really close to the characters, and then kind of like in a broader view. And of course, that's quite near the end, where a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
But between all this happening in the realm of Midgard, you do have one character, and I'm not going to spoil it by saying his name. It's a he, you know. They are stuck in a really interesting place, which is very much between realms.
Yeah, very much between realms. Yeah.
I'm going to have to say this because I can't not say it, but the way he finds himself in an area of pitch blackness, nothing, and if he makes the slightest sound, he gets killed in 100 different ways, and he must have been through 100 different ways by the end of this book. I thought, how many times have we had to think, okay, how can I kill him now? How can I kill him now?
Every time it was a problem, and sometimes he would die like 3 times in a chapter and be like, oh no, I have to come up with another way now. But that's the challenge of it. So,
Did you have that in mind for having him in that experience of being between the realms in a very not nice dimension, we can literally say? Or did it come quite organically?
Came, as with many things, quite organically. So what happened in this situation is actually I'd written what used to be the first book. And I needed a different kind of opening, and I couldn't figure out what the opening should be. And on Christmas Day, actually, some years back, I all of a sudden got the spark of an idea, and I wrote the first Darkness chapter. So, and realized that there was a whole journey here that was unexplored and that I needed to put into the story, and that would help tell the larger story throughout the volumes. And so, that's basically where it came from. And I think it came from this fear that most people have that when you die, there's nothing. What if there's nothing? And Ragnar he's a skull. Oh, no, I said his name. I'm sorry, I've spoiled it.
Don't worry.
It happens early on, guys. It happens early on.
No one knows how he gets to this dark place yet.
But he's a storyteller, and so he is completely convinced. He knows exactly where he's going in the afterlife. Like, there's no question about it. So the fact of taking a character like that and putting him in such uncertainty, pretty much in his worst nightmare, it really appealed to me. And then still giving him some kind of hope, but just completely stripping away everything that he thought was real, while also giving him the hope that it is real. You just didn't get there, and why didn't you get there? That must be a reason. So he does have this hope of finding out what is happening and why, and can I get to where I'm supposed to be, and all of that, which pretty much takes him through the whole story arc of the book and the series.
Well, you explored really well through his placement in this darkness. The kind of like the very visceral fear that all humanity gets when we find ourselves in the unknown and threats are everywhere, but also when we have to dig deep and like, okay, what can I do instead? What can I do different? And in a crazy way, that's a strong theme that comes through in 1 and 2 that I've recently seen with my child. And I'm not going to spoil that one. But I really liked how at one point in the darkness, he feels around for things and he comes across a prophetess's iron rod staff. And I thought, oh, I've seen that in a museum. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I love how he used it to then try and take back a little bit of control, albeit mm-hmm. he's still in a very dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you open up and explore the aspects of the gods more. And yeah. I found it really interesting how you portrayed Odin and Loki binding their brotherhood together mm-hmm. in that scene, which comes a lot later in the book. I thought that's a really interesting take, that it might have been Loki's idea, or Odin was trying to do something, but Loki says, oh, I can help you with that, yeah. but we need to do something.
He's always conveniently there to help out. Yeah.
But yeah, that was really, and of course they then go, slight spoiler, they go to the Volva to bind mm-hmm. their blood together. And of course you've got runes riddled, pun intended, quite literally throughout this book. Yeah. And I really like that, the amount of runes, because of course they're always, at least in modern minds, always associated with magic. Yeah. They cannot be, modern minds can't perceive them as an alphabet. They're always to do with magic. They're always in circles or in kind of like spells and all that kind of
thing. More bind runes is what we see today, right? So they, which would have maybe some magical appearance, but it is also just a way to write that is really convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, which meant that a lot of people were literate because it was quite easy to learn runes. So you could you could read. Yeah. Mm. But I think
you go on.
I was just gonna say that for me, runes are interesting because they both have that mental aspect, the magic to it, but they're also something physical. So there's mm-hmm. something to literally hold on to. And when you read some of the old sagas and things like that, sometimes when they do a spell, what really makes the spell is that they will physically write the rune on the thing that they want to put the spell on. For example, if you want a magic sword, then you will have to physically carve in the runes that you want on the sword hilt, because otherwise it's not going to be transferred into the sword. So it's a physical thing. It's not just something imagined or just a symbol.
That's a really good point. Because, of course, I'm only vaguely familiar with runes from having multiple rune sets given to me over the years, because, of course, that's a nice gift to give to someone who's upset about Vikings. But, yes, so I would love to know more about how you then... Because, of course, there are two other books following Northern Wrath, and I will find time to eventually read them.
Yeah, you mentioned the distaff, the staff that Ragnar finds, which is on the cover of the second book. So that kind of gives an idea of where we're headed, and that it is important, as you say.
Yes, so kind of like, did you then, after writing Northern Wrath, did you have a bigger plan for what would you then write for book two and book three?
I always had the whole arc kind of. I knew sort of where we were headed, so I knew where we needed to end up. And actually, it used to be the last chapter of book three. I think it's now third to last chapter, but it's the biggest one of them. It's really the ending of the book. I wrote that as I was writing Northern Wrath. So I wrote the ending of book three as I was writing Northern Wrath. And then every time I was in doubt about something that happened as I was writing on, I would go to the last chapter and I would just flesh it out a bit. And then I would go back and I would know where I need to go. So I knew exactly where we were going to end up. And it's just some characters took unexpected turns. Hilda, for example, never listened to me, so she never did what I wanted her to do. I had a very clear story arc to map out for her. I was like, it's going to be great, Hilda, just come on. And she was like, no, I'm going to go that way. Ah! So yeah, I spent the three books trying to chase Hilda into doing what I wanted her to do, and she never did. But I still got her to the end that I wanted for her, so that's at least something. So yeah, I very much knew where we were headed. For the first book, I had everything mapped out, and then I could see that I could kind of let go a bit and just follow the characters and see where they were headed and what I wanted to explore. And so, but I still always knew where we needed to end up. So there was always an end goal in mind that all of the characters had to work towards in order to get us there. Yeah.
I love that. I know I dabbled, but I say dabbled. I used to be a writer of sorts back before university, when I did do creative writing as part of my English degree, and I did write, and Norse stuff was pretty much in everything. Whether it was, if I had stuck to poetry, they were all poems with Norse elements. That was the other way. I mean, I wrote horrendous poetry. I can never do a good, not rhyming poem, and then my rhyming poems were even worse. But in terms of short stories and short fiction, I really enjoyed writing it. But I sometimes, when I did once have a novel in mind, it was always a delight when you found that you, as a writer, you know what you want your characters to do, like you're directing them on stage, and then they decide to basically ad-lib and improvise and then things take a different route.
That's a
really good sign of how good this book is, dear viewers and listeners, that she has such a connection to her characters that they tell her what to do, not the other way around.
Yeah. especially Hilda. But there are a few characters. There was one character who would never tell me what she was up to. So this is not going to be a spoiler for anyone, but it's Siv. She would never tell me anything that she was going to do. So every time I knew I had to go to her, I was like, I have no idea what's going to happen, but I guess we'll see. And she just went with the flow. Yeah.
Very good. Apologize to any viewers listening. I'm not being beamed up by aliens. The sun is just coming through the one window I have open. So I'm just being illuminated wonderfully by the sun. This is why I should have kept the curtains shut. But I thought daylight, I could be illuminated by daylight, but this is too strong a daylight. It's the winter sun. So, but anyway.
It didn't last long, unfortunately. So that doesn't bode well for the weather.
It's fine. For those listening on audio only, you won't know any different. It's just me, my voice, not any different. So I'd love to learn more about your experience on the Sea Stallion, because how long did you spend sailing it? Did you have to spend time training to go on it? Or did you have long voyages, short voyages? Wait, did you say two?
All the details. So first of all, to be a part of the crew of the Sea Stallion is also to take care of the ship in the winter. So first time I was there was actually just to prepare the ship. So we would tar kilometers and kilometers of rope. We would tar the deck. We would repaint the outside, which needs to be done every year because, you know, seawater kind of digs into it. So there's a lot of maintenance to be done. So that was the first time I was there and I met the crew, and then went out for a training sail, which is a weekend. So we would go out both days and then sleep on the harbor. First time I was on the Sea Stallion was the time that it has sailed in all of its history with the fewest crew members, which was very good for the first experience because it meant that you had to be everywhere. Like, you had to have your post, you had to be there, you had to do it. There was no other choice. We couldn't get the sail up without everyone being at the post and doing it perfectly. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot that weekend. And then I just kept coming back for more. So there will be several training weekends throughout the season. And then when we get to summer, there's usually a bigger sail, which would be anywhere between 1 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sign up for 1 week at a time, or you can sign up for all three. So the longest I've been on the ship was for 3 weeks, which was a great experience. It's always a bit strange when the 1 week is over and you get a new crew, because by the end of the week, the crew is so good. Like, everyone knows exactly what they need to do when. And sailing a Viking ship is that is the collaboration of a lifetime. It is everyone knowing their places, knowing what to do, when, how, and just doing it without question, perfectly in sync. Even sometimes when you get really good, you don't even need to say the word, people are already doing it because they know it needs to be done. So when you sail with a really good crew, you can definitely feel it. So when you get that changeover after a week, you feel like, oh, we're starting over again. Okay, we gotta get into the routine with some new people. But it was very rewarding, very fun. I've been everywhere on the ship. So there are different posts and different places. I've been everywhere. So I think my favorite is probably being the Midshouter, which is basically a parrot. Because a Viking warship is long and slim. So it's very long. And when you're out at sea, with the wind flapping, with the sail, the huge sail in between, you can't hear from one end to the other. So when commands are being shouted, you literally cannot hear it at the other end. So you need a person in the middle who shouts commands on to where they need to go. Otherwise, you can't communicate. So you need someone who can communicate between the different ship parts, especially in like emergency situations, things like that. You need to have someone who is quick at it. And so that was really fun because you got to pretty much dangle over the side of the ship and shout from one side to the other. That was fun. And when we were rowing, you got to sit on the yard and then shout around the mast and then shout. So that was really fun. And there's just something satisfying about hearing a command said, repeating it, and then seeing everyone doing it in unison. That's really satisfying. That was fun. I was really, really lucky when I got there. They all knew that I was a writer. They all knew that I was passionate about Vikings. And so they really made an effort to get me around the ship and, you know, sure that I got to experience everything. It was very fun. I think a lot of people think that being on a Viking ship is a bit different than what it is. I think a lot of them are shocked at, for example, how do you go to the bathroom is one of the most questions that we get. How do you go to the toilet? And because it's just a ship, it's just open. Yeah. There's no indoors. There's nowhere at all. So we have the luxury setting, which means that we have a little tent that kind of covers you here, and then there's a bucket.
Yes. I was going to say, there's always going to be a bucket.
There's a bucket. But the thing is, the tent only covers you here. So you're sitting on the bucket and can literally see a person sitting right next to you, chatting to someone else. So
I
think a lot of people, the first time that they're out for a long time with the ship, that's the main mental break. Is like, even on the toilet, I can't be alone. Like, I have to be around other people constantly. Yeah. And so it's quite interesting to see the first 3 days as people are kind of avoiding the toilet situation. And then on the fourth day, it's just like, I don't care anymore. I've done it now. Now it's done.
Yes.
So one of the sailors very early on told me, I have a trick. I'm like, okay, what's your trick? My trick is, I'm scared of the toilet. So the first thing I go, as soon as we go out, I go to the toilet and it's done. And then I know that I can do it, and I can do it from there on. I always thought that was quite funny. But yeah,
it makes me think of course, the famous man on the loo in the Jorvik Viking Museum, because like, he thought only up to there.
Yep.
He's very much visible, very much straining, poor guy.
You can just say conversation, no problem.
Right, that they found.
I mean, that is the way of it, right? And it goes for everything when you're aboard a ship. Like, you're never alone. There is no place to be alone. You're always like this, shoulder to shoulder with someone else. Because although it's a long ship, we're still like 65 people on board.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So you're like sitting like this, shoulder to shoulder with someone else. You'll be lying down across people. When you sleep at night, it's literally shoulder to shoulder, and half the crew is still awake and sailing the ship and things like that. So it is a very communal experience, and it would have been exactly the same for the Vikings. I mean, I
was going to ask about sleeping.
Yeah.
How did you sleep? Was it easy?
So we went into a port and we would put up our tents and we would sleep there. So the Vikings did that a lot as well, because they used to follow the shore. If we're sailing during night, which is the best times, then we would sleep on the oars. So you have the long ship like this, and you have a mast in the middle. So you have both sides, starboard and port side. Mm-hmm. And so whichever side that we're sailing on, the ship will usually tilt. And so we'll on this side, we will put the oars out. We will roll them out on top.
Okay.
And we will sleep on that side by side like this on top of the oars.
Wow.
Yeah. Usually with some tarpaulins over us and things like that. Yeah.
So I just had images of like the oars being used to make some kind of tent, literally, like you say, like kind of like getting them erect, then just drape
I mean, that would be on merchant ships, but not on warships. There's no space for that. They're too narrow. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So how long did you go? Well, I know your longest sail was 3 weeks, but did you do it for a number of years, or was it just for 1 year?
So I kept coming back for like 3 or 4 years, I think.
Good on you.
Last time I sailed with it was last year, but I think it might be my last sail, because it might be difficult for me to get away now during the season. But yeah, it's been a continuous thing throughout the years, which has been really fun.
Wow.
Yeah. It has a really lovely crew. I mean, that's the thing that keeps you coming back, right? So many different kinds of people, so many nice conversations to be had, and there's just you get to know people differently when you're that close all the time. Constantly. Yes. And you have night shifts together, you're sitting with a little cup of hot cocoa or whatever it is you're drinking, and freezing, but like, look, it's pretty. that is a different kind of experience. You're cuddling at night because it's just cold. So you get to know people in a different sort of way. That's very nice. Wonderful experiences.
So I know you've got this trilogy under your belt. Obviously, I've come to it a few years too late, but I'm here. I've read it. I've got
never too late for anything.
I have been there for a lot longer, so don't worry. But is there anything else you want to maybe write that returns you to this world of Viking Age history or mythology?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain what-if ideas that I quite like. So what I've written since hasn't been Viking-focused, so I feel like that was something I needed to explore, and then there was something else I needed to explore, and I wrote that. Now I'm writing something else that's fantasy, science fiction fantasy right now. Science fantasy, mm-hmm. is what you call. But I can see somewhere down the line, maybe returning to something Viking inspired or something that jumps off from this. But for now, I mean, doors are open, but I am going to be writing other fantasy things, other historical mm-hmm. fantasy things for a little while, just to explore other interests as well. And then mm-hmm. we'll see what, if I get around to coming back to it, who knows?
Well, I will continue to shout out about this trilogy as I read it each and every book. Don't worry, because I can't leave that. The cliffhanger you've left that book, I can't not read the next one. That's why I put it on my Christmas list. But in terms of course, us both sharing a shared interest and passion for this topic, is there anything that you've read or watched or played that has Viking elements, Norse Ooh. Elements in it?
Oh, I mean, I try to consume a lot of this.
That's
I'm a bit of a Viking break, I must admit. But I have, I did watch. I mean, obviously, I watched Vikings, so that came out when I had written the first half of the first book. So I started watching that, and obviously, I played Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which I really enjoyed. Actually,
I'm so far behind in that one. Parenthood just robbed me of gaming time and reading time. Yeah. I think I got as far as conquering three counties in Anglesey, England, and that's where my A-ball still is.
I quite liked it because there were certain, like, sometimes it would be small things, but I'd be like, oh, that's an axe from there and there and there. And, like, I would know the reference. Yes. So I enjoyed that aspect of it a lot. Gave it, like, kind of an extra bonus because I did so much research. Mm. I feel like it paid off. I could name things and where they were from, which was fun. Recently that's that. I haven't started yet, but I just gotten hold of Bengali's books, which I hear are Norse inspired. So I'm going to be trying those out soon.
I don't think I've heard of that before.
Yeah, I think that's my January read, so we'll see how I get along with that. But yeah, otherwise, recently,
Now, I'm curious, because you've obviously played Assassin's Creed Valhalla, did you play their Viking Age Discovery Tour? Which is...
No.
You need to... It's what they've put out free. It's like a free DLC, effectively. It's very educational.
Okay.
It has no stealth and stabbing in it, so you can play it without fear of death at all.
Okay, that's good.
And I do highly recommend it for anyone who just wants to know why I'm so passionate about Vikings to begin with, because it puts you in the position of... a Viking. I think it is Harald Bluetooth.
Oh, okay.
I think there is a king that basically it must be, because Ivar's father, who's a clan chief, says, okay, I'm going to submit to him. That means your inheritance is gone, Ivar. I'm sorry, but I want peace. Yeah. And Ivar's like, no, I will go join Sigurd and we will go off to England and we'll find glory and riches and death and that kind of thing. But yes, there is. You follow the journey of a Norse trader who then decides to leave for England to settle down, form a kingdom, form his little farmstead, that kind of thing. But you also follow the same path of an Anglo-Saxon monk. So you see it from both sides.
Interesting. Yeah.
And they do go into Norse mythology quite nicely. It's a third chapter in the end, and I loved that bit. If you want to get a sneak peek, please do go to my humble streaming streaming podcast series of Playing with the Norns, because I have two videos. You can watch it, but I do recommend you play it anyway. It's good fun. It's got lots of fun little anecdotes, not just about how they made the game in terms of concept art and voices and using the runes and that kind of language, but they also show off different artifacts that they have generally gone to and studied. Like, they came to York, they went to the Jorvik Viking Museum. Yeah. So I give them a big thumbs up for that. As well as kind of like the museums, I'm sure, in Denmark and Norway and that kind of thing, to really touch base with everything Viking. I'll always be miffed about why they decided to make the north of Anglo-Saxon England in the game always winter and then everything else summer. I mean, it doesn't work geographically. England's more rainy now than ever. We don't have snow these days anymore, unfortunately.
That's one of those common misconceptions as well. I mean, if you talk about Vikings, it's got to be snow. It's got to be mountains. I wrote the first part of the first book doing my MA on creative writing, and one of my tutors wrote back, I'm missing some mountains. And I had to tell her, listen, it's set in Denmark. There are no mountains in Denmark. Just because she had a searching of Vikings and mountains. Like, I'm sorry, but there are no mountains in this whole land. Like, I can't just put them in there.
My closest family love to wind me up whenever they see something Viking with horns. I go, Rebecca, it's wearing horns. So you tell them off, and I'm like, really? Everyone knows now Vikings don't wear horns, but it's such a grafted image. It cannot be separated.
No.
It really can't. I mean, even children. My daughter will grow up knowing that a Viking image is just of horns because otherwise they would just look like any other Anglo-Saxon or any other kind of like 10th century warrior helmet.
It's kind of genius marketing that happened later. Like, look, Vikings are cool. Look at their helmets. They're fun. It might not be true, but like it did give them an identity that makes them very recognizable to a lot of people. And I think that's why a lot of people know Norse mythology today, even though I don't personally like the horned helmets. Please no. Please don't include them in the media, but like I recognize that it had a positive effect, I think, on the interest of a lot of archaeologists in the period as well, because it became hip. It became cool, which is the same with the Marvel things. Like, it became cool. So now people are interested in it, and I can only say, thank you for that. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it was one question I actually got asked at the Mary Symposium during my debut academic presentation about Valkyries in fantasy fiction, because they're my catnip. I just, anything Valkyries, because they're so unknown, I just love how many aspects of them they're interpreted. But I was got asked, like, do you think anyone will go and read the sagas after reading a Thor comic or reading a book about Loki or a Valkyrie? And I'm like, I'm not entirely sure. Some might not, because I personally, I have touched on the old sagas. I'm looking at a copy of Grettir's saga and this another saga book over there. But on the whole, I just like all the different modern interpretations. Mm. I like the different ways of retelling and adapting and modifying. Mm. Like, there's so many different books about Loki, and they're all recognisably Loki, but they're all unique and different. Mm. I think people want more of that. They want more, not to see new, but refreshing, original. And that's why, of course, I loved your book, because it is refreshingly original compared to all the other Norse fantasy books I've read, especially with the elements of history. I always find that a really careful balance for you as writers, to balance the historical fiction with the Norse fantasy instead of just going straight to Norse fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that drew me to your book, of course, was the wonderful quote from my heroine, Joanne Harris. Because, of course, her series of Runelite, that came out when I was trying to write my now forever forgotten dusty work in progress novel about Valkyries being active in York. Mm-hmm. Because I thought, no one's written about this thing before. And then hers came out, and I thought, you know what? She can have the crown, because it's just wonderful. And plus, she knows her things, and she's as passionate about it as I am, and I've followed her around ever since. But the quotes you've got for this book are well deserved. Very well deserved.
Thank you. I've been so blessed with that. Especially, I mean, Joanne Harris is a funny one, because the Gospel of Loki had come out a few years before Northern Wrath came out. And I love that book.
Yes.
So when I was writing Northern Wrath, I felt like this pressure. What if people come in and they don't know anything about Norse gods, and they don't know, like, how am I going to explain this whole world to them and the lore and everything? And then the Gospel of Loki came out, and I was like, I'm just going to tell them, go read the Gospel of Loki, and I'm all set. And so it kind of solved this big issue that I had. I was like, do I have to include all of this behind the scenes story in order for it to make sense? Or can I take it out, let readers figure it out, and those who want to learn more can go and learn more, and I can direct them this way? Like, it just removed a huge amount of pressure, because it was so well written and such an interesting retelling of the sagas, of the old Norse stories. It's kind of weaved together from Loki's point of view, and it pieces them together in a way that it all makes sense, and it comes into a bigger ensemble, you can say. It fits together.
Yes.
I think she did a wonderful job on that. So yeah, I felt very, very, very blessed, first of all, to have that book come out from her, and then she goes and reads it and gives me a quote that was really, really nice of her and really lovely.
She's awesome. She's awesome. I'm quite chuffed in that I know she lives somewhere in my neighbourhood area of West Yorkshire. I just don't know where, obviously, because I'm not going to go stalk. But I've worked with her a couple of times on this podcast, talking about anything. Speaking of, that has reminded me, actually, have you come across the Ragnarok series on Netflix?
I have not watched it, but I have seen it recommended to me.
I recommend it to you.
Okay.
I think you'll like it.
I've been hearing that a lot recently. Like that, I think there are 3-4 different people who've recommended to me recently.
Well, I got Joanne Harris and Professor Caroline Larrington, who of course is another academic top hat in the world of Norse mythology. And we had a really fascinating podcast discussing and reviewing all 3 seasons. So don't watch that episode because it'll spoil it for you. After you've watched all 3 seasons. But yes, make that on your Christmas binge list because it's wonderful compared to kind of like the Marvel or gods turning up in historical dramas like Vikings kind of thing. Because I think that was the one thing that lured me first about the Vikings was where there's a scene, like, I think it's in the intro, where there's a scene of the battlefield and of course the tall figure with a big rimmed hat and slushing around, walking around. It's one series that I didn't quite follow Vikings. I think I got to season 4 after Rollo had settled down in Normandy and some
I kind of fell off at that point as well. I think I came back to it and finished it some years later, but I personally, and this is a gripe I have both with that series and with the Assassin's Creed one, actually, is their interpretation of Eva the Boneless. Because I've read the historical accounts of Saxo Grammaticus, which tells the histories of Denmark, and I grew up with that version of it. And to me, Eva the Boneless is the biggest hero of all. And so seeing him portrayed as a traitor, as a mean person, as a horrible human being, it just feels so wrong. Like, I feel so wrong whenever I see it. So that is unfortunately a gripe that I can have with a lot of things because I've done so much research. So when I have an opinion of something and I see it, it's completely the opposite way, it's just difficult to accept and swallow. But especially Eva, because he is my biggest hero in all of the Viking stories, he is the one I love the most.
Very interesting.
So the version of him in Saxo Grammaticus is so different from anything that's portrayed in modern media. I know obviously modern media probably relies more on the English language accounts of it instead, which obviously we'll see him as an intruder
That's a real good point about the sources and what's used and what's not behind all these things. I mean, I think that's why I was impressed when I did play the Viking Age tour of Assassin's Creed Valhalla, because it showed how international they went, especially around Scandinavia and not just on the UK side of things, to really capture the big impact on the cultural and the movements and exploration of the Vikings through their artifacts and research.
Yeah, and they went to the Mediterranean Sea. They've traveled so far.
It's questionable how they present that in the sequel series, Vikings Valhalla. Because that is a real mishmash of timelines, and I've had 3 really interesting episodes.
Vikings series is a mismatch of 300 years of history snapped into one.
I mean, a lot of me and my guest panelists all agreed, like at the end of every episode recording, reviewing each season, like, why didn't they just focus on one character and do that as a season and do another character in another season? Because there was enough drama, genuine drama in all 3 of them to not merge them together.
Exactly. I agree. It was one of my biggest gripes as well. But then I get it. Like, you want to convey a story and you're worried that if you switch characters, like main characters, then your audience is not going to follow you. Like, I get the reasoning. I just don't love it.
I think they really were trying to have their cake and eat it.
And
that's why it got cut so short, being season 3 was last season. But the way they ended season 3, they clearly had drive or plans for season 4, which I think actually would have been interesting to see, because that got onto what I call the real Game of Thrones of the 11th century, because of course Canute eventually, he does die in season 3. Sorry, spoilers, he does die, but historically he also dies.
Historically they're all dead now.
A lot of them were dead when they should have been, and a lot of them were little when should have been little, but they were all grown up and in the band, like Harold. Why? You're not. And then, of course, Leif and... But in terms of heroes, going back to kind of your point about Ivar the Boneless, like, for me, it's always been... Well, it came through quite late during a lot of reading, but it came down to Queen Emma of Normandy. Well, Queen Emma of England, but she wasn't Normandy, Emma of Normandy. And, of course, her then second husband and father of her son, Canute, because I thought he is... Of course, in England, we have the old... dusted off story of him trying to turn back the tide and getting sweet wet, but he did so much more. And I did like how in the series Vikings Valhalla they showed him meeting the Pope, even though that was a really unconventional meeting of the Pope and involved someone dying and someone getting a head in a box, and it totally wouldn't have happened. They'd have all been arrested and put in prison if they had murdered that person. But yes, I do think they showed him in a better light.
I still think he came across as a villain. Like, he came across as a despicable person, which to me feels really off, just because the version of events that I grew up with, and the reason I think he's such a hero, is that he's the one who united all of the brothers and got them to be able to work together in the story that I grew up with. And he, or in the Saxo-Grammaticus version of stories, I should say, and he's the brain behind it all. And he is a hero, a battle hero as well, but a hero while being disabled. And I think that's really important that someone like that can rise to that kind of status in the Viking society. I think that's kind of a key component, that he can be so well respected and accomplish so much and accepted as he is, and he's accepted for his strengths, and they all recognize that he's an incredible strategizer, and he can divide the kingdom between them. They don't have to go off and fight each other. I mean, that's in the Saxo-Grammaticus story, that's kind of his strength, and his whole story arc is built around that he is the one who is the driving force. It's a positive driving force. So when you see the other side of events, it's like, oh, okay, I understand that he's an invader and all of that, but why is he the only one that's villainized? Why is the other brothers not, right? Because to me, he is the driving positive force, and the brothers are kind of combative and want to fight about things. And he's like, no, listen, we can get along, we can do this. So to see him always be the only one that's villainized and the other brothers all positive and good, that's, I think, where my gripe is, and what usually, gets me the wrong way. It's like, but he is the actual hero, and now you've butchered him and made the others heroes.
That's a very good point in terms of how we portray people of the past.
Yeah.
So I know, speaking, there's a series that... I'm assuming you probably haven't watched it, which is Twilight of the Gods. Also,
that one's been recommended to me as well. Yeah.
That's a very, very strongly flavoured interpretation. I know when I showed Caroline Larrington the trailer when we were all together in Stavanger for the Mary Symposium, she was like, "Good grief, what is this?" And I'm like, "I know, they've got swear words, and there's a dragon, and there's all sorts in it." And it was interesting, but by the end of it, I actually quite liked for how strong a take they did. They completely this isn't for those who are familiar or more comfortable with Marvel's version at all. This is like mead plus 10% alcohol in a way.
They stuck to it.
But it's interesting because they depict the giants, Thor and Odin, in a very antagonistic sense. Without spoiling too much, they depict Thor, first of all, as the bully with a hammer that he is. And I really salute them for that, because that comes through in all the sagas.
Yeah.
And I mean, they don't make him incredibly stupid like some of the sagas do. Like, I always remember when he has a shouting match with a Jotun across the river, but it's actually Odin in disguise just winding up his son in a very humiliating manner. But that's the way Odin works. Odin himself isn't a good guy, let alone a good father. But yes, that is to be taken with a pinch of salt, because they do twist and adapt things, but they do it very cleverly. And especially with Loki, Loki's character has a very new exploration of his character, his motives, his agenda, and they sum it up beautifully with one episode which pretty much focuses him, which is the scapegoat god. And I thought that's a brilliant way of looking at him. I do recommend it, and I have got plans of, I'm currently recruiting guests to join me to discuss this for an episode to be recorded in February next year, 2025, all being well. I have seen, so if you want to binge it over Christmas holidays and join the ranks, you are more than welcome back at any point. My usual recruits have all been rather busy, including Caroline and Joanne, for like their own, they've got their, they're very busy doing their own books or projects. And now Joanne's like been doing a perfume competition and a writing competition, and Caroline's doing this, and Louise Dowell's been promoting her new book, and Kat Rector's only just moved house. So it's all a case of everyone else I usually talk to about anything horse is busy. So this is why I'm always looking to get new friends, new guests.
Of course.
Because I always say to anyone who meets me, and especially when they connect with me on this kind of topic, is once you meet me, you can't really escape me much after that. I'm sorry. You'd have to like put a law against me to not talk or message you again. But this is what happens. I talk about Vikings and I cannot stop.
I love it.
And I think I pretty much have talked about anything and everything else I can think of. So Tilda Coldholt, I really appreciate you joining me on this podcast milestone of episode 10. So thank you very much. Everyone do go buy her book, Northern Wrath, the first in the Hanged God trilogy. It is well worth a read. Mm-hmm. You won't regret it. Yeah. And Gran Harris even rates it. So, that's the beautiful edition cover she's holding up, everyone. I really could have that one, but my bookshelf is full. I cannot fit it on.
Straight from the press.
It's got the beautiful coloration on the edge of the pages with the design. If you put all three together, they make a complete picture.
Yes.
Oh, you lucky author, you.
I know. I've been very, very lucky.
I don't think even Joanne Harris has special editions like that, but that one is gorgeous. I keep telling my husband, if we can just give me a Becky cave so I can have more shelves and
space,
all my geeky artwork back. And then I don't need this virtual background. As nice as this Valhalla is, I can show everyone how much of a geek I am on Vikings, because I have a lot. And I'm admiring your wonderful full bookcase behind you, Tilda, because there's a lot of books there, and I hope that you've read all of them. But don't worry.
I'm sure some of them there are still to be read, but that's how it goes.
Thanks again for joining me on episode 10. I wish you the best of luck in all your future writing endeavors, and I do hope you get to sail with a sea stallion one last time.
Thank you.
Hold on to it as tight as you can, because it's an experience that many of us would love but are unable to have. So I'm glad that you of all people get to enjoy that experience. Maybe write a book about it, or I don't know, so I can then live it vicariously by reading about you.
Love it.
But thank you very much for joining me, and I hope maybe we'll have you on the podcast again soon to talk all things NOS.
Lovely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.